Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. We need to continue, and we're covering the Constitution, so I want to get through the obligatories as quick as possible so that we can cover the content, because we only have so much time. I mean, folks, this is the ninth month of the year. We're already 9 months into the curriculum, and we've got a lot of other things that we need to cover in content, which is one of the reasons why I'm not doing the, you know, the little, I'll call it, what I used to call marketing, where I'd actually point out how bad things are. We'd talk about the news, and I'd say, what's it going to take? What's it going to take to get you involved? I mean, here we've got evidence. They're doing this. They're doing this. And, you know, they're killing people. Folks, learn, pray, act. Folks, it is all about full compliance. No cherry picking. We need full compliance to the Constitution. We don't want to marginalize the rule of law. Now, I have my presidential campaign. I've talked about this. I don't talk about it that often. If you want to run for elector in the upcoming presidential election of 2028, we need to get started in getting your Secretary of State to placing electors onto the ballot. The parties have no constitutional authority to control, and the state legislatures had no constitutional authority to change who was to choose the electors. It's not the parties. So, again, if we want to have these conversations of getting a real constitutional election moving forward and truly forming a constitutional electoral college, I'd be willing to be the candidate for anybody that wants to get their names on the ballot. We'll work together. So that's what we're all here for. And welcome back, Sean. Folks, we've got Sean, who is working with us regarding the reading of the Constitution. So, Sean, are you ready to dive into this again? And so one of the things I have to point out is we commonly mute ourselves when we start the show. And so, you know, that may be, I don't know, that may be the points of sometimes I have to point that out. But I don't think that's the case. Welcome back.
Thank you.
No problem. No problem. So if you remember, we just kind of wrapped up and started covering Section 3 of the Constitution of Article 1, Article 1, Section 3. And we literally just kind of covered the very first part. So let's dive into Section 3 and let's start from the top. So that way we have because this is all about the Senate. We want to have kind of all the things covered in one single show, and we're only talking about a sentence, so let's go ahead and take it from the top.
Section 3. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, chosen by the legislature thereof, modified by the Amendment 17.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. For 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote.
Okay, so like it states, that instead of the legislature, that red text, if you've got our color-coded Constitution violations, that red text isn't actually highlighting a violation. It's only pointing out that that part is what was changed by the 17th Amendment. The reason this is important, folks, is because we need to point out what the 17th Amendment really did. There are way too many people in America that point to the 17th Amendment as a boogeyman. Oh, we got to undo that because it's taken away our state suffrage. It did not do that. Now, we can rescind it because the dolt that Vice President Biden really was, he was the one that opened the door of getting the government to allow states to modify whether they ratified or not, or whether they rejected. And he got Delaware to formally reject, or actually ratify, because they formally rejected it. They changed their position and ratified, which means that any state that ratified can now formally reject that. So technically, you can rescind the 17th Amendment. I think there's a better dialogue, and we'll talk about this when we go through this next part. So let's go ahead and read this, because this next part includes the other part of the 17th Amendment. So let's go ahead.
Immediately after they shall be assembled in consequence of the first election, they shall be divided as equally as may be into three classes. The seats of the senators of the first class shall be vacated at the expiration of the second year, of the second class at the expiration of the fourth year, and of the third class at the expiration of the sixth year, so that one-third may be chosen every second year.
Okay.
And if vacancies happen by resignation or otherwise during the recess of the legislature of any state, the executive thereof may make temporary appointments until the next meeting of the legislature, which shall then fill such vacancies, modified by the amendment number 17.
Yes. Okay, so what we see are the only language. This is the only language that the 17th Amendment changed. Do you any of this language here talk about the state suffrage?
Nope.
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, we covered this last time where we pointed out, and I read, Article 5 actually protects the state suffrage, that the state's equal suffrage in the Senate shall not be denied without their consent. The 17th Amendment didn't ask their consent to give up their suffrage. Therefore, when they ratified the 17th Amendment, they only ratified the process of the selection and replacement of the senator. Didn't modify the constitutional requirement that they have to literally provide suffrage for the state legislature. Now, didn't we talk about, because I'm getting old, didn't we talk about, you know, the definition of suffrage, meaning that that means that they're to vote the will of the state legislature, just like our representatives in the House are really supposed to vote the will of the people. Now, we talked about the challenge of the will of the people being all over the map, which gives a member of the House of Representatives a lot of latitude, because there's not a real good mechanism. Not that we can't use technology, hint, 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 where this is where we're going to go down a rat hole, folks. But not that we can't use technology, but I am here to tell you that when we look at the suffrage for the state, we can actually invoke laws that will actually hold them accountable to vote very specific ways. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
That's how it was intended.
Okay, correct. Therefore, as we kind of look at this live, because did I not use the term live governing?
I believe you did.
I did. So when we really look at this ability for the state legislature to actually, you know, poke and prod and tell their senators, you know what? If you think you can vote contrary to what we just told you to do when you go in to vote on this treaty, on this bill, on whatever it is you're going to do formally in representing us, and you think you can do it contrary to what we've told you, then we are going to charge you with violating your oath, because this is what the state has to do. The state can clearly state that any federal representative in Congress, whether it be the Senate or the House, if they fail to support the Constitution in their representing their constituents, because when it comes to the Senate, it is a demand that they give them their suffrage. Therefore, they create this law that if they have been identified as violating their oath for failing to provide suffrage that they are legally bound to provide, because in a representative government, that's what our representatives do. They're giving us our suffrage. Again, we've talked about the difficulty of how to do this with the people. But I think we even talked about how this because we have bicameral legislative bodies in the states, correct?
Yes, sir.
Right? Okay, so except there's one state that's unicameral. Do you know what that state is? Starts with an N and ends with a K.
Nebraska.
There we go. So Nebraska, after the 17th Amendment, they kind of looked around and go, you know what? We would like to really lower the cost of our government. because at that point in time, government wasn't, you know, regulating energy and everything under the sun. And so they said, well, let's get rid of the House of Representatives, because when we look at the 17th Amendment, technically we, the people, you know, have control over both houses in Congress now. Oh, how wrong they were. Again, like I'm telling you, we, the people, do not have control. We only have the ability to decide who should be representing the state legislature for them, because the state legislature was basically guilty of, and I'll just say this, they were guilty of failing to seat senators. That's why the 17th Amendment came to be. These were progressive states that deliberately kept the Senate from creating quorum. So the Senate was actually having problems doing their job. Ergo, what they did was they proposed the 17th Amendment, allowing the people to choose who is going to represent the state. That's all they did. This is the importance of understanding the language of the 17th Amendment and the only few, the two changes it made. So therefore, as the 17th Amendment went forward, and by this point in time, 1935, just a less than, actually 22 years later, right? 1913 to 1935, it was just 22 years later, the paradigm had changed and shifted so much that they felt that, hey, you know, we look at the House or all of Congress as only representing the people now. They were wrong, because they were illiterate on the Constitution. They were illiterate on the Constitution well before this, but that's because the education system started attacking and subverting what the Constitution was. This happened in the 1880s with the Fabian Society. So by the time we got to the 1930s, they had changed and revised what the education-wise, what the Constitution really stated, what it meant, and nobody was understanding it because they weren't teaching it. So therefore, Nebraska went ahead and did the dirty deed of creating a uniform, or I should say, a unicameral legislative body. Now, here's the point. When we realize, and at this point in time, if you haven't come to this, and as a matter of fact, I'm going to ask you this, Sean. If you look at asking the state legislatures to openly vote on, you know, the House and the Senate of the states to determine how they want their senators to vote, and you have a split, I think I mentioned last time that one senator would vote one way and the other senator would vote the other way, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Let me just say this, that why don't we just force the issue down to the state itself? In other words, this would require an amendment to the Constitution, but here's the question. If the framers would have had the technology that we have and understanding the suffrage of the state legislature being paramount, going through the Constitutional Convention, that was one of the number one bones that the small states picked on not supporting any changes to the Articles of Confederation. They wanted guarantees that they would maintain their equal suffrage in the Senate. Had they had the technology, do you think that they would have actually gone down the path of maintaining a proxy and not put a system in where the state legislatures themselves would be able to vote for those two votes that they have in the Senate?
Oh, absolutely.
Therefore, I believe an amendment to the Constitution would quickly pursue when everybody starts realizing this. Then why would we not amend the Constitution to actually either do away with or make these guys, you know, they don't need to have a grand status of a senator in D.C. anymore. They're just proxy votes. And those proxy votes could be randomly basically handed to members of the House, because when we look at the Continental Congress was being manned by fewer people. Many states weren't being represented, and representatives of other states were actually proxies for some of those states that weren't there. So there's no reason why members of the House of Representatives from that state can't be identified from 6 months to every 3 months or rotating it around. You're going to be our proxy. We will tell you exactly how to vote. If for some reason we do not have comms to actually cast our vote at the time of voting, you will vote these ways. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I like it.
There you go. I mean, I'm not a genius, but I believe anybody, as they start looking at this, can act, and somebody could come along with even a better system, possibly. But it needs to ensure the protection of the state suffrage in that Senate. And the reason why we couldn't get the League of Nations is because the Senate wouldn't pass an amendment to allow or wouldn't vote for the treaty that would have allowed us to be subjugated to the League of Nations. Oh, well, guess what happened in the 1930s? Everybody realized that the Senate wasn't representing the states anymore. This is why Nebraska did what they did, and this is why we joined the UN, which was FDR's little baby. Both the League of Nations, the globalist government, the initial attempt was an American, you know, concoction. The United Nations was an American concoction by FDR. So anyway, I know I've really dove into a real rat hole. We've spent a lot of time on this, but I'm hoping everybody realizes that the 17th Amendment isn't this pig with lipstick like everybody thinks it is. We have all our ducks covered, that the state legislature suffrage was protected, and it's protected in Article 5, and we'll review that when we get to that again. But the point is this, folks. We need to understand that the 17th Amendment only changed the manner of how they're chosen and replaced. That's it. Now, the rest of Section 3 dives into some of their roles and responsibilities and so forth. So let's go into the next paragraph.
No person shall be a senator who shall not have attained to the age of 30 years and been 9 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state for which he shall be chosen.
Okay.
Party qualifications via primaries is not listed.
Okay, so let me just do this, because the reason that little added party qualifications via primaries is not listed in this statement, so that's a little add-on. That's not a part of the Constitution. But this whole point, you see how it starts, right? That no person shall be, right?
Correct.
Okay. So when we look at that as, what is that? When we look at the color-coded Constitution for enumerations, and we actually go to Section 3, because there are different things that are actually enumerated in the Constitution. The roles and responsibilities kind of sets the up top. It sets the fact that the role and responsibility, you know, is the choosing of the Senate and so forth. And so when we look at the language here, no person shall be. In other words, this is the language of a standard. In other words, this is what a senator, this is the requirement for a senator. When we look at the language of the 14th Amendment, Section 3, and if you want to jump down real quick, down to the 14th Amendment, and you look at Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, how does it start?
No person shall be.
There you go. In other words, they're using the exact same language as a qualification and or eligibility standard for a person to be in office. So don't confuse Section 3 of the 14th Amendment as anything other than a standard. You violate this standard, you are no longer eligible to be in office. You're to be removed immediately. This is why you hear me say this over and over. Folks, I start yelling when I've said this over and over to people, and they're not getting it because they keep on saying, well, it's got to go to the court. No, it does not go to the court. You have violated your eligibility. You have done something that made you ineligible. You don't go and collect $200. You are removed immediately. This calls for the immediate removal and banishment, that you can never be a public servant ever again. That's why it ends with this. But Congress may, by a vote of two-thirds of each house, remove this disability. So in other words, they're to be banned. They can never go back until, once they've been removed, until Congress removes that disability. They've disabled themselves from being in office. Did that help? Does everybody see and understand, you know, this is a standard. What we're reading here, no person shall be, that's a standard, just like Section 3. Okay. So let's go into the following then. Go ahead with the rest.
The Vice President of the United States shall be President of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided. The Senate shall choose their officers and also a President pro tempore in the absence of the Vice President, or when he shall exercise the office of President of the United States. The Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. When sitting for that purpose, they shall be on oath or affirmation. When the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside, and no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of two-thirds of the members present. Judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. But the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to the law.
Okay, so let me just say this. Everything you just read from this, from the standard, right, from the no person, that paragraph is a standard. It is a lockdown. This is the requirement for a senator to meet. Everything else that you just read, were those powers? Does the Senate, anything saying that they have the power to?
No, it's roles and responsibilities.
There you go. So, folks, if you're looking at both color-coded constitutions, you'll actually see what each of these lines that Sean is reading is an enumeration, but it is not an enumeration that they can create law regarding. In other words, there's nowhere in there where they can actually create, you know, they created these rules for themselves that it requires 60 votes to pass, you know, for them to pass a Supreme Court justice to make sure that, you know, there is a greater concurrence than just mobocracy. They wanted to make sure that it wasn't just a simple majority, that there was a threshold of what that majority would be, which was 60%, right? And so we've seen that, because you know who imposed that 60%? Who actually set those standards? Guess.
Do not.
Okay, that's fine.
Madison?
No, Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson, when he became the vice president, and because John Adams was the first vice president, and John Adams basically was just, you know, filling the seat. I hate to say this because he was a good man, but he was really more high on himself than he was in really trying to help administrative procedures and so forth. So when Jefferson actually became the vice president, he's the one that kind of created the rules, the you know, this whole process of how they were going to administratively manage themselves. And so it was Jefferson that created this threshold of 60, and you know how that they needed to vote on very specific things when it came to a bill or a law. As a matter of fact, Jefferson wanted to actually see an amendment that basically stated no law could be passed during, you know, a term or during a year until the next election occurred. He wanted to make sure that government moved very slowly and that the people could inject by changing their government, by changing the players, to ensure that those laws don't pass if they didn't agree with them. I mean, everybody loves those kinds of ideas, but when it comes down to the declaration of war and exigencies and things like that, it becomes kind of difficult. So now we actually are going to go into a break real quick. So as we go into this break, it's just a quick promo, folks. We're going to come right back and we're going to dive into Section 4 of Article 1. So please stay tuned and we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now we're going to get into something that's kind of unique. This is something that actually doles out a responsibility, a role of responsibility. And, oh, by the way, it's being violated. But anyway, it's now this role and responsibility for somebody other than the federal government. So this is Section 4 of Article 1 that Sean's going to kind of start reading. We went into break, though, and so are we ready?
We're ready,
sir. Okay, awesome. I'm sorry. I was presuming that you weren't ready, and so forgive me, please.
Use your prey, my friend.
Okay, so Section 4. Go ahead.
The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. But the Congress may at any time, by law, make or alter such regulations, except as to the places of choosing senators. The Congress shall assemble at least once in every year, and such meeting shall be on the first Monday in December, modified by Amendment 20, unless they shall by law appoint a different day.
Okay, so that very first part is technically a role and responsibility for somebody that's not Congress.
The legislatures of the state.
There you go. And so here the Constitution actually goes down the path of saying, you have to do this, state legislature. Now, to be very clear, but it says and it follows, but the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulation except as to the places of choosing senators. Now that was changed by the 17th Amendment, right? Now, because the 17th Amendment basically says that the state legislature doesn't have any control over it. So that little places of choosing the senators, that little last part was modified. Okay, so anyway,
I wondered what the places was referring to.
Okay, so the places for choosing senator was at the state legislature. Now, when they create the law where they declare the election, the state legislature is the one that's supposed to determine the time, place, and manner. So it only gives the state legislature the ability to create a general election, no such thing as a primary, just so you understand this. Okay? That's why.
That's the part of it, though?
What's that?
I'm just saying for logistics' sake.
Okay. So the other part to this, but the Congress may at any time by law makes or alter such regulations, that is added as an ancillary role to the calling forth of the elections, only in the case if the state legislature is incapacitated because of an invasion, an insurrection, or what have you, then Congress may move forward to do it for them. but the responsibility of calling forth elections, as it states, the first it goes to the states. The federal government just can't come in and say, you can't do that. If they do it, then it's done. Only Congress has the ability to do it if the state is disabled or, you know, can't do it for themselves. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, the federal government has actually dictated the time and date as to when the elections occur, the first Tuesday of November, or this is, you know, first or second, whatever it is. Doesn't matter. They've declared that. They've made that the national day of election. Does this give them the ability to do that instead of the states doing that? No.
Does the phrase the Congress made any time by lawmaker alter such regulations?
Yes, so actually, if the states understand that, hey, they may want to actually wait because of farming or what have you, because they are in a different climate than the other states, they have the right to actually execute their election whenever they want. The federal government cannot establish by law that this standard has to be. It has to go to the states first. That's why it leads with the state's responsibility is precedent over the federal government. Again, the federal government only has this responsibility in case a state has been disabled. So that's not the case that the states have been disabled. What they've tried to do is they've tried to make it so, and I'm not going to argue the importance of probably having a presidential election on one day. But for the federal government to dictate that day, or maybe they went out to the states, because this may be the backstory, maybe they went out to the states and said, what day is best to do the federal presidential election so that we have an outcome where it doesn't literally take a whole month or two for, you know, the all of the states to conduct their election. Prior to, you know, this establishing, if you go look it up, you'll find when they did this, when they actually established that day of November. Bottom line, whether the states did it or not, the federal government couldn't do it, but they did. And the states have allowed them to do this. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so the states have allowed them to do this. So actually, and this is the point, other states or any state could actually come up and say, you know, we're not going to do it then. And actually the Western states could actually say, we're going to do it the last Tuesday of October. What would that do? That would provide precedence that the I'll just call it the momentum and or the energy of the presidential election would then start with the West Coast instead of the East Coast for once. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, because as we've watched the elections roll from the East Coast all the way to Hawaii, by, you know, everybody's complained on the West Coast, hey, it's not fair that, you know, by the time, it, you know, we come into the president's already chosen before our election polls have even closed. Ah, so I'm just pointing out, folks, that West Coast states or even Hawaii could actually, you know, do their election on Monday and change the demeanor of the elections themselves. So anyway, I like to throw the wrenches out there because, you know, it makes people think, huh, wow, that would really be interesting. Because it creates relevance again for the West side of the Union. If you look at how the primaries have been played out, who has the advantage in the primaries? Who's the first state that has the first primary?
Iowa.
There you go. So Iowa kind of sets
South Carolina now.
So there you go. So as they start realizing, hey, we want to have a stronger invocation or a stronger initiation of the presidential election or the primary, absolutely, the states have the ability to determine when they're going to do it. This right here does not facilitate the primary. As a matter of fact, the primary is not constitutional. As a matter of fact, for the president to choose his own vice president instead of the Electoral College, we'll get into that when we get to Article 2. I mean, it is contrary to the Constitution. The electors will choose who they believe is best for president and who they believe out of the field of presidents who would be best as the vice president. And it's been done before to where they would actually go for a Republican or a Northern president and a Southern vice president, a Democrat. Right. It is for the electors to choose, not the parties. But we'll get into that when we get to Article 2. Okay, so now Section 5. This is kind of interesting. Go ahead.
Each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members, and a majority of each shall constitute a quorum to do business. But a small number may adjourn from day to day and may be authorized to compel the attendance of the absent members in such manner and under such penalties as each house may provide. Each house may determine the rules of its proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and with the concurrence of two-thirds, expel a member, modified by Amendment
14,
Section 3.
There you go. So actually, if you look at the color-coded enumerations of the Constitution, what are we looking at that's being enumerated here? Are these roles and responsibilities, or are these standards? These are standards, because Section 3 actually replaces this. The House of Representatives can no longer determine whether they want or has two-thirds. If somebody has violated their oath, Section 3 demands their removal, not a two-thirds for expelling. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
And nobody has ever even mentioned that all of Section 5, these two first paragraphs, have literally been superseded by the third section of the 14th Amendment. This is how constitutional literacy has actually allowed us to be subverted the way we have. But that was the intent behind Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And what ended up happening after the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868? In 1868, the Radical Republicans were reelected in the House and in the Senate. But we see in 1870, enough of the Radical Republicans were replaced by Democrats, or I should say, we'll call them rhinos, because bottom line, they weren't supporting the Constitution. They didn't put into place these changes, and this is when America would be being undermined by the money and corruption of Britain and a lot of other things, the Organic Act, all these things started falling into place where our nation literally started taking a different direction. Now, they were already on the wrong direction in many ways, but this is when, because of the 14th Amendment, Britain said, we're not going to stand by and let these guys continually slap us and, you know, take our money and play these games with us. So they started, instead of throwing money into warfare, they actually throw money into American politics and bought representatives and senators to literally get into office to ensure that Britain's interests were going to be protected. There you go. So let's go to the next one and talk about the journals and so forth. Go ahead.
Each house shall keep a journal of its proceedings and from time to time publish the accepting such parts as may in their judgment require secrecy, and the yeas and nays of the members of either house on any question shall, at the desire of one-fifth of those present, be entered on the journal.
Okay, so what is that? What are we talking about there? That's a role and responsibility, right? But they're talking about how each house has not been doing a good job and actually publishing their proceedings. Technically, they should have, and actually the Senate was kind of, you know, kept apart. But after a certain point, the Senate actually started producing its journals, or actually documenting the debates in the Senate. So this is why when you look at the congressional record, somewhere around the 1800s is when the Senate actually started opening up their journals or actually taking those records and publishing them with Congress. I think that around that point in time was when the Congressional Globe began, because if you look at the Annals of Congress, which is the very first records that was kept by both House and the Senate, you look at a sterile view of what was going on in the Senate. It was just the proceedings. That's all they published. They didn't give you the debates. The debates came when they opened up and said, okay, we'll debate, we'll put all of our debates out there, because the only thing we need to suppress are those matters of secrecy. So they started actually publishing their debates that weren't affected by that. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. I had a question, though, on the part accepting such parts as may in their judgment require secrecy. What do you know, or what have you seen about the discussion and debate about this section and what they considered required secrecy?
So treaties.
That seems pretty broad.
Yeah.
It's in a lot of trouble.
So they disclosed that it would not be good to publicly disclose, what they were talking about in the treaties or anything else until the treaties were passed. So those types of things were considered secret or things of national security, because the Senate was actually involved with the president in foreign affairs regarding treaties. Congress was involved in regarding, the commerce, but the decisions regarding, because if you, when we look at the responsibilities of the Senate going back up to Section 3, with the advice and consent, the president shall choose and select his ambassadors. And so they actually have a little say on who those ambassadors are going to be, or who the judges and who the executive committee, or I should say secretaries of the departments and so forth. So the Senate kind of has this involvement, and they have a little bit of investment in foreign affairs, because the interest of the state legislature being commerce and our foreign relations, most U.S. citizens don't care about that. They only care about if we go to war. They only care about the taxes, which is why the House of Representatives kind of has the control of the purse strings and has more of the focus in declaring war, as far as I see this, because they're the ones that actually will get replaced, very quickly if they declare war and the people don't support that war.
Right.
Okay, so as I see these secrecies, it was really more of what was happening with the national defense and those types of things. Congress had the responsibility of, providing for a Navy and maintaining the Navy. And the Navy was the secret strategic defense system. The militia was a responsibility of the states. Right. So Congress really didn't have, other than providing for the militia, equipping, training and that type of stuff. But if they're not being deployed, but the Navy actually was being deployed. So this relationship with foreign affairs and what the executive was doing with his Navy was something that the Senate would probably be privy to, where the House wasn't. And I think this is where they started defining committees and so forth. They all wanted to have their own committees that related to these things, but the committees themselves is where the secrecy was to be maintained. And so as we kind of look at this concept, the secrecy is being maintained in the committee. This is one of the reasons why they said, well, we don't have a good reason why we are going to, open up our journal, because these things don't contain, or I should say the normal debates on the floor do not contain things that are secret. They shouldn't. The committees, they maintain that. Does that make sense?
Right. I understand.
Okay.
But they still should, keep a journal of it, even if it's not published. Is that what this is saying?
Yeah, so they actually, this is interesting. The Constitution gave them the ability to to kind of keep, you know, not to be transparent, to actually allow the government to have, you know, a veil between what they were doing and what the people would hear. Right? So the Constitution was kind of giving them this veil. But the forefathers, or I should say those who occupied the federal government, leaned for transparency more and more. So that's one of the reasons why these journals and all of these things were being provided and being, you know, published and so forth. Right? I mean, you're seeing that they're actually giving them the ability to not give us transparency, right?
Right.
Okay. But
because it's in their judgment.
Correct. And what they did was they set the standard. And this is one of the reasons why we've heard a lot of lip service from, I would say, progressives and Democrats, as well as rhinos. We want transparency. We want to give you everything. But they don't. Because they know they're doing, you know, they're grinding agendas and so forth, and they don't want people. I mean, we're just finding out about Obama's role and involvement in the shenanigans over our elections. That man needs to be pulled into Congress and be impeached, which basically would mean that his whole family would lose access to the secret security, because the whole point of impeachment is to remove the emoluments. When we get to impeachment, we'll see this, that the impeachment is not to punish them for a crime. It is to remove them from their station and all emoluments. So his retirement pay would go away. His security detail, if he wants security, he has to pay for it for himself. And then once the impeachment is done, the Senate will be, because they will be found guilty, he should. And so, therefore, he would be then tried for treason in engaging in political endeavors to that directly undermined the government and an election. And so, anyway, yeah, there we go. All right. So, did you read that last part?
Neither house during the session of Congress shall, without the consent of the other, adjourn for more than 3 days, nor to any other place than that in which the two houses shall be sitting.
Okay. All right. So that closes Section 5. Now we're going to dive into Section 6. And so this identifies the benefits package for all representatives in Congress, both the Senate and the House of Representatives. Please, folks, pay note to what they are entitled to in accordance with the Constitution. Now, I want to make this very clear, that from Article 1, Section 1, to Article 1, Section 5, including 6 and 7, these are not sections that Congress can just willy-nilly create a law and change. In other words, when we look at these benefits, they cannot grant themselves anything more than more compensation. They cannot grant themselves a health package, a retirement package. Only those things that are authorized is the only thing they get. So let's dive into this. Go ahead.
The senators and representatives shall receive a compensation for their services to be ascertained by law and paid out of the Treasury of the United States. They shall in all cases except treason, felony, and breach of the peace be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of their respective houses and in going to and returning from the same, and for any speech or debate in either house. They shall not be questioned in any other place.
Okay, so they're protected from arrest or harassment unless they've committed a felony, right? It says right there, treason, felony, and breach of the peace. So what this means, folks, and this goes back to the states passing laws to, you know, pull these guys back. They need to make it, because I didn't dive into this on Section 3. We basically stated that they need to create a law that when the state legislature has identified that they have violated their oath and have provided the clarity that, you know, has to do this, in this law, the only way a person from Congress that can expunge their, you know, their record is that they actually have a common law grand jury review whether they actually violated their case or not to determine whether they can get back into office or not. Therefore, they're immediately removed, and if they feel like they've got a shot, this common law grand jury is a grand jury made up of the counties of the state, not one little pocket of, you know, people that are in favor of that person. Does that make sense? Like the little vicinage of where they came from, because these are representatives of the, this first Senate, this is representatives of the entire state. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so the reason this is the case, because if a senator, so if they fail to step down and come back to the state, if they want to expunge themselves, they have so much time. Because how long does it take for a person to be replaced? When we look at the political process, it takes about a month or two. So they have just that much time to get back to the state, demand that they have a common law grand jury assembled to actually make, to present their case to say, I've been wronged here, and I want, you know, I want, and the grand jury will have the power to reinstate them. If they can't be reinstated by the time the governor replaces them, then it's all over. Doesn't matter. Because they're not entitled to due process. I think there's more than enough time for them to get back and for the state legislature to provide them with a state grand jury. Not, you know, and actually, the way that grand jury has to be formed, it'll be done by the legislatures of each county. In other words, the county supervisors or commissioners will determine who will represent them in the grand jury. And therefore, each county will be equally represented to ensure that there's no shenanigans or any favoritism going one way or the other. These people will be completely impartial, and they will judge whether the violation was material and substantive. And if it was, then the guy's gone, or the gal's gone. They're gone. Now, getting back to this law, then if they fail to vacate and come to the state, then that would be a felony, because now the state has to extradite them. And in accordance with Article 4, Section 2, if anybody has committed a felony, they can be extradited back to the state. And there you go. So now if they fail to voluntarily step down, then they've committed a felony against the state law, and now they'll be extradited. So either way, they're coming back. Does that make sense now? Because yes, I didn't give you this information regarding what the state needed to do to enforce the removal of a senator from office. They only need to have two laws created that actually supports the Constitution and Article 5.
That's what I was going to ask. Has Section 3 of Amendment 14 ever been used to remove someone?
No, so that's kind of what I was saying, that in 1870, before Congress could even really start, you know, making these changes, so in 1868, three states started challenging their ratification. In other words, three states ratified, and then they ratified, and then later they decide, hey, you know what? We want to change our ratification. Well, technically, you can't do that. Well, so that's what ended up happening, and we were running out of time. Obviously, I apologize. I was completely blind to how much time we had left. So, Sean, if you would, please remember that question so that we can dive back into that when we come back tomorrow. Anyway, folks, as you can tell, understanding the Constitution is paramount. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.